Tim, thank you, and I love being here. We are, by the way, for those of you who weren't here this morning, just so you know, the church here at Cornerstone is planning a trip to Israel in 2022, and so if you'd be interested, we'd love to talk to you about it. It's a genuine study trip. I don't have this plugged in, so that'll do that to me every once in a while. All right, well, let me pick up where we left off this morning. We're looking at the book of Daniel, and we are going to get through all the chapters, but as I said this morning, the book rather, it divides itself because the first six chapters are narrative, although one of those chapters, chapter two, includes a hugely important predictive prophecy, namely the four, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But then the last six chapters are just predictive material. Eschatological. Do you know the word eschatological? Eschaton from the Greek word for last or end times. And so predictive prophecies that relate to the end times. Now, I said this morning, and I want to go back to this very briefly. We're going to go to the chapter. So we do have a lot to cover. I'm not going to keep you late. I appreciate the kind offer. But Tim's offer is genuine. If you need to leave at any time, we won't take any offense at it, but I'll not be real late. But the thing is that what I said this morning is that Daniel lives at an unspeakably precarious time in the history of God's dealings with Israel and with mankind, because Daniel lives at that time when the southern kingdom, Judah, and specifically, remember, Jerusalem. I mean, the northern kingdom had fallen to Assyria. All right, that was a rebuke, but the temple still stood. The glory cloud still hovered over the Ark of the Covenant there in the most holy place. And so, in Jerusalem, right, when the northern kingdom fell. But now, in the days of Daniel, the southern kingdom, Judah, Jerusalem, is going to be defeated and horribly desecrated and destroyed by the Babylonians. And as we say, when that happens, it is going to be the intuitive impression, not just impression, it's going to be the intuitive persuasion of all the rest of the world that evidently Yahweh is not nearly the God they had thought him to be, because after all, his people were defeated by the Babylonians who worship Baal and a number of other gods. So the point is that the name of Yahweh is unusually, and one could almost say in terms of Old Testament history, uniquely in jeopardy of being universally disreverenced when God, in fulfillment of his covenant promises, he promised that if they continued to disobey, he would raise up a conqueror, and they would be carried to the ends of the earth. I didn't do it this morning. Let me just read you that, because there are a couple of places where we encounter it, but I'm going to take you to Deuteronomy. I'm going to throw it up here, and I think I got the New King James here. I hope you can handle that. I think you can, but So let me take you to Deuteronomy, and you want to go there with me, 28. Now, I'm going to fiddle with this thing until it drives you crazy, but it helps me. So, 28, and I believe I should have nailed it down. It's 66. I got it highlighted here. Now, this is a compelling passage. Now, again, all right, I never want to just step into these passages without some context. We are on the plains of Moab. Moses is 120 years old. He has led them from Egypt through the Red Sea to Mount Sinai, where they became a nation, and now he's brought them to Kadesh Barnea, and they did the wickedness, ixnay on the unquestke, I like to say, and so therefore, the one generation lies, their carcasses lie in the wilderness. But now he has brought the believing generation to the plains of Moab, and Moses is about to die, but before he does, he reaffirms in the most dramatic fashion the covenant that God has made with Israel. The King Yahweh, who is, after all, if we can go to Moab together, to the plains of Moab, in the house. I mean, as Moses delivers these messages, it is perhaps against the backdrop of the tabernacle with that majestic glory cloud, that pillar of fire, which is so brilliant you can't look upon it. And so therefore, God encases it in a heavy cloud or mist, so that by day it looks like a pillar of cloud, but by night you don't see the cloud, it's a pillar of fire. But that, and by the way, we've had some experience with that cloud, because it's been protecting us from the sun through the wilderness wanderings and so on. So my point is that it's a rather dramatic scene. And God uses Moses to reaffirm this covenant relationship. And the whole of Deuteronomy is a covenant document. And as was the wont in those days, when a people would make a covenant with a sovereign, a suzerain, there would be a document that spelled out the blessings for obedience and the curses for disobedience. And now God, and he has spelled them out. If you disobey, your children will die young. You'll sow much grain and you won't reap and so on. But the greatest and the most awful of the covenant curses, which God promises that he is going to visit upon the nation of Israel if they insist on disobedience, is that they'll be carried off. Let me read it to you. He says, "Then the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other, and there you shall serve other gods which neither you nor your fathers have known, wood and stone, and among those nations you shall find no rest." Now, time out. I think we're going to apply this to the Babylonian exile, specifically, because that's what's happening in the days of Daniel. But as we read it, just ponder how perfectly this describes the status of the Jewish people for all of these thousands of years as they have been. Jesus says in Luke 21:24 that Jerusalem shall be trodden underfoot of the Gentiles until until the Messiah comes. And that picture of trodden underfoot is just such a perfect representation. So I'm saying that we can apply this, and we will apply it, and God does apply it to specifically to when they're carried off to Babylon, but that's just the beginning. By the way, don't get lost in this bookman, but remember that you've got what Daniel is going to tell them is that there are going to be four kingdoms. And Babylon's only the first of the four kingdoms. And Babylon's going to be succeeded by Medo-Persia, by Greece, and by Rome, and so on. So I say just to make the point that this is a description. God says this is going to be your lot if you insist on disobedience. So let me pick it up in verse 65. "Among those nations," get that out of there, "you shall find no rest, nor shall the sole of your feet your foot have a resting place. There the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing eyes, and anguish of soul. Your life shall hang in doubt before you. You shall fear day and night and have no assurance of life." Now listen to this. This is such a poignant description. Think of this. "In the morning you shall say, 'Oh, that it were evening.' And at evening you shall say, 'Oh, that it were morning,' because of the fear which terrifies your heart and because of the sight which your eyes see." Now, that's the promise. If we go to, I'll just leave it at that. That promise is going to begin to come to pass now when they're carried off to Babylon. Now, on the other hand, I have the spiritual gift of speaking out of both sides of my mouth. But honestly, it's legitimate here. Because they are going to be carried off. On the other hand, because of Daniel and the fact that he's carried off early, and because he does interpret a dream in chapter 2, we're going to talk about it in just a minute, Daniel prepares the way so that the Babylonians receive the Jewish people being carried off with remarkable kindness for a time, just as in Egypt they were treated well for a time. All right, having said it, my point is, this is where we started this morning, that Daniel is hugely important for those two reasons, by the way. Maybe you didn't hear him, but number one, because he is going to cushion the blow of the Babylonian exile. And he's going to prepare the way in such a way that the Jews are, the Jews of Judah, those southern kingdom as they're carried off in 586, are treated with remarkable deference almost. And secondly, and this is the important point, that Daniel is going to be used to preserve the glory of the name of God internationally because at this time. Now, that's what I want us to look at. So what I'd like to do is tonight and tomorrow night, we're going to look at the five or six vignettes. Now, why five or six? It seems to me that one and two are kind of one story. We'll talk about both of them. But in chapter one, well, I won't go through it, but I'm going to kind of combine those two. And then chapter three, which is, of course, the story of the fiery furnace. It's interesting, I mentioned this morning, that we watch both Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar grow old on the pages of Daniel 1 to 6. Because Daniel is a young man, maybe 13 or 14 years old, when he is taken captive. Nebuchadnezzar was born very close to 630. Maybe it was a quarter to 7. No, 630 B.C. is what I'm trying to say. So he was born about 630. And of course, the initial deportation when Nebuchadnezzar carries Daniel and the three friends back and so on, among others, is 605. So he's 25 years old. So he's a relatively young man. He's an accomplished general. I'm talking Nebuchadnezzar now. But he's going to go back with Daniel and his friends to secure the throne. So he's very, very, very newly ensconced as king. So then let me just say it this way. I know you spelled it out, but I think it's interesting that the first two events, namely chapters 1 and 2, which is taking the young men and then having the dream and so on, happened when Nebuchadnezzar is quite young and newly on the throne. I'm going to suggest, I won't get dogmatic about it, but I'm going to suggest that very possibly Daniel 3, the fiery furnace, happened when about 8 years later. So Nebuchadnezzar is in his early 30s. Then we're going to jump all the way in chapter 4 to when Nebuchadnezzar is probably at least 60 years of age. And so, and Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel have grown old together. You got to understand. So in those four chapters, 1, 2, 3, 4, you have these at least three or four times where Nebuchadnezzar confronts the God of Israel. And it's really a remarkable series of events, not only with regard to Nebuchadnezzar, but just as importantly, where we want to go most importantly, how God uses this to preserve his glory. Does that make sense to you? So let me just take you through these stories. And you had some notes this morning. I think they were out there. I don't know how much attention I'm going to pay to these notes, but here they are in front of us. Because I'm going to tell you the stories very, very briefly. You going to get some, Tim? All right, we'll see. If not, they're here, and I'm going to use these notes as a way to get quickly through these, I'm going to say, three narrative events. The first one, anybody need one? A set of notes and so on. All right, chapters 1 and 2, I would suggest, it's on your right, Tim, on your right here. I would suggest chapters 1 and 2, it's good to take it together. All right, so let's tell the story. In chapter 1, and again, we've talked about this extensively, but Assyria has ruled the Eastern Mediterranean world and beyond, Mesopotamia and so on, for almost 400 years. But a young general by the name of Nebuchadnezzar, who is the son of a king in a rather small upstart kingdom called Babylon, and his father's name is Nabopolassar, sets out angry to destroy the Assyrian Empire, the Assyrian armies. He accomplishes that at a place called Carchemish in 605 B.C. Now again, it is Nebuchadnezzar now has to bring. I said this morning that he goes from country to country and capital to capital, telling them to change the address on the check every year. So as you send the tribute money back, you're not going to send it to Assyria, you're going to send it to Babylon. You're going to send it to the emperor at that time is Nabopolassar. He is in the midst of that effort when word reaches him, Nebuchadnezzar is, that his father has died. And he is certainly the prince royal, the heir apparent, But nonetheless, he needs to get back and secure his kingdom. So he makes his way across the desert, and he takes with him these three, well, the Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, probably others, but they become pivotal to the story, so we get to know them. Does that make sense to you? They are taken back as both, I think, some political leverage on Nebuchadnezzar's part, but also clearly to be trained. There is clearly a three-year training. Now, I'm not going to spend any time with it, but in point of fact, Daniel does show himself winsome and wise and committed to the Mosaic law even early on. You remember that story about how because, and this is a very special privilege, and Daniel, certainly the king would have anticipated that Daniel and his friends would be very, very much smitten by, I say smitten, very much delighted by the fact that they were going to eat the king's fares. They were going to eat at the king's table, as it were. But not working? Oh, yeah. That's all right. But of course, that involved eating meat, which was evidently, I think the issue is that it wasn't kosher according to Levitical law. And so very wisely and politely, he goes to the chief steward, the chief eunuch, and asks permission for a 10-day test. And at the end of that test, I don't know if I can get away with this or not, did I mention that before? But I'll just tell you, this is one of my life verses I like to say, but I'm teasing. But at the end of the day, and I like the King James here, it's the real Bible, don't forget that. No, I'm teasing. The fact is that in the King James, it says at the end of the 10 days when they appeared, not only were they wiser than all the other young trainees and so on, but they were fairer and fatter in flesh. I like that. I was going to say, today it's got to be svelte and tanned. The biblical standard is pale and chubby. I can take you right to it. There it is, fairer and fatter in flesh. I'm working on that. But the point is that God does intervene, and so let me read you the end of Daniel chapter 1, where, and these are some of the highlights I just want to, now at the end of the days when the king had, and this seems to be not only the end of the 10 days, but the end of the training period, when the king had said that they should be brought in. So now this is the graduation ceremony, as it were, for these men who have been brought in. And let me just say that clearly, a very important part of the reason that this policy was pursued again and again was because it was this idea that certainly the royal family, people who are aristocratic and in power, are just intrinsically more worthy and brighter and so on. So we'll take the cream of the crop, the new king, Nebuchadnezzar, and we'll bring them back. But they would bring not only young princes and so on, but they would always bring representatives of the various gods. And because you got to learn a little bit, to be sure, vicariously. Don't be buying any of this. But you got to learn to think in terms of how a polytheist would think. So we have our gods, and they're special to us. And the king would say, I reign in the names of that god. But there are other gods. And the gods were often, remember when Elijah led the northern kingdom in a battle against the Arameans, the Syrians, and roundly defeated them. And the excuse of the Syrians was, well, their God is a God of the hills, but our God is a God of the valleys. See, so if we get them down in the valleys, then we'd be able to defeat them. So this idea that different gods, so at any rate, they would collect a lot of gods. Now, that's going to be very important to this story in chapter 2. But let me leave it for a moment. The point is that it's the end of the, like I say, this is the graduation, and that they should be brought in. The chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's their Hebrew names. They're going to be given the Babylonish names. Remember that? I don't know. This is what we used to have. Your shack, my shack, and a bungalow. Remember that? But that's something else. At any rate, these are the three. Therefore, they served before the king, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. So God blessed, and these young men excelled and so on, and they're going to be exalted. Now, I want you to see that last verse that I highlighted there. Folks, this is so important. It simply says, it seems like a throwaway line, but it's not. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, folks, you know what that means. And, of course, that's Daniel 6. Daniel 6, it's Darius the Mede, and everybody is you know, trying to figure out exactly who it is. I rather think it's another name for Cyrus, but I realize that's not a majority position. But the point is that by the time Daniel 6 happens, Babylon has fallen to Persia. Now, I want you to just contemplate this. This is more important than you might realize. Daniel outlived the Babylonian kingdom. Think about that now. God's man, the prophet, actually, he was there at the birthday. Everybody acknowledges that the, what's called sometimes, and you'll see this, you should be familiar with it, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, because it was an earlier empire, and you've heard the name Hammurabi, the Code of Hammurabi. Well, that's an earlier in the 1500s. But now, in the 600s B.C., there is a new Babylonian, and everybody acknowledges that empire was born when Nebuchadnezzar hastened home and took the throne. Daniel was there. And everybody acknowledges that it was buried in Daniel chapter 5, the handwriting on the wall, when Belshazzar saw that handwriting, and that night the Persians came in and destroyed the Babylonian Empire. Took it over. It was really already, it was ripe fruit. They had conquered everything but Babylon. But the point is simply this. On the one hand, God did raise up Babylon as the rod of his anger, as the means by which he would fulfill his covenant promise to carry a rebellious Jewish people off. But it is so instructive that God's prophetic voice outlives. And not only does he outlive it, but he is going to be promoted to a place of tremendous authority in the Persian Empire. Now that speaks volumes to the man Daniel, and the wisdom of Daniel, and quite frankly, the governmental acumen, if you don't mind, of Daniel. That because usually when one nation, one people, one even ruling house, but in this case one empire, destroyed and replaced another, the first order of business was to get rid of everybody who was significant to that because they're going to resent it, not Daniel. Daniel's actually exalted in the Persian Empire. It's really stunning in terms of, but I want to go back to it, and I need to get to it, but it that little throwaway line is unspeakably important. In the very first, he's going to continue until the time of Cyrus. Well, let me take you to chapter 2, and I developed the story here. I'm just going to tell you two very quickly. Now listen, Tuesday and Wednesday night. See, the first six chapters are historical narrative, and they are so pivotal. And they're interesting. They reduce themselves rather happily to a flannel graph, so we've heard them for a long time. You know what I'm saying? I use that line all the time. Most kids don't even know what a flannel graph is. But the fact is that those six chapters are hugely important, but in chapter 2 and then in those last chapters, you have these predictive prophecies, and that's where we're going to focus the last couple of nights. But let me take you, so what happens is that, and the reason I like to combine these two stories is because this seems to be a flashback, because we read in Daniel 2 that in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, now, the graduation probably didn't happen until the third year. So this is very possibly a flashback. There are different ways to handle this. But at any rate, while Daniel is still a very young man, and because in chapter 2 he still seems to be in training, quite clearly, because what happens is that Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Now, I'm going to assume a certain amount of knowledge. I'll tell the story sort of bare bones-ish. But what happens is that Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and I said this morning, I'm going to reiterate it because it's so important. There's an interesting verse in Numbers chapter 12, and it actually is in the context of Moses' brother and sister, Aaron and Hur. Remember that? challenging whether or not he's the only one who speaks for God, and God comes down and puts an end to that argument. But in so doing, he says, basically, do you know who you're messing with? God, speaking of Moses. And he says this, if I speak to a prophet, I'll speak to him in dreams and visions. Now the point in Numbers 12 is, but not so with Moses. With him, I speak face to face. Remember the glowing face and the veil and so on? So that's the kind. But it's just interesting that you have that kind of incidental line that the standard means by which God revealed himself to a prophet was dreams and visions. It's interesting that in 1 Samuel 28, remember when Saul went to the witch? It says that he went to the witch because God would not speak to him by dream, by prophet, or by Urim. Don't get me started. But the point is that it's clear that a dream. Now, here's the problem. Not the problem, but I think the impulse that we have to check. When you read that, you tend to think of your dreams. And there is nothing to do with the nocturnal meanderings of your subconscious in and out of any sort of reality. Okay? Disabuse your mind. And by the way, I hear that all the time. Several times. I don't know, Tim, if you ever run into it. But people will say, oh, yeah, God speaks through dreams. You need to, I went to ETS once years ago. But, you know, you need to record your dreams because the Bible says, and this is how God leads you. Baloney. All right? The fact is that I like to say it this way, that there is a fourth dimension. We can call it, as Mike Heiser does, the spirit world or the unseen realm. But would we not all acknowledge, and does the Bible not make make rather incidental reference to the fact that if we had the eyes to see, this room is full of spirit beings? You believe that? Both fallen and unfallen. They are engaged. Oh, we're going to see it in chapter 10. I don't know that it comes out any better, so I shouldn't be talking about it here. But chapter 10, where you have the prince of Persia, Gabriel, who was delayed by the prince of Persia, and there is this, really there is this explicit reference to this spirit world warfare that goes on, and it's real. And you and I are sometimes, in some sense, the object of their focus and concern. And I cherish that. Let me just tell you, this is a bit of an aside. But we are so often, especially in some of the circles in which I've lived, perhaps, but human history is so often represented as some prescripted drama where we all learned our lines in eternity past and don't know it. And we're just walking through. We're so many puppets. Just that is simply not true. There is a sovereign God who orders human history. I don't understand how to make that consist with the simple reality that human history is a real drama. And there is a real warfare going on. And that warfare involves not only us, but this spirit world. That makes sense to you? We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against these principalities and powers. Now, I would argue that spirit world is not only real, but it's very much a part of our world. It's not another realm. We have no access unless God on occasion allows us access. Oh, I could give you a lot of social. I'll tell you what got me kind of hot about this is I do a lot with the life of Jesus. I mean, I teach it and spend a lot of time reading about it and so on. And I've come across several scholars or students of the life of Jesus, who ought to know better, who have opined that the temptation was not real. The temptation of Jesus, the experience in the wilderness, that was illusory. That was something happening in his head something happening in his head that was not real. I got to stare into it. Shush up. There. Me and my computer. But No, and you know why? Why would they say that? Well, they'll say, where is that high mountain from which you can see all the mountains, all the kingdoms of the world? Well, I believe that mountain exists, but it's in a fourth dimension. See, that whole temptation, don't go here, Bookman, but that whole temptation narrative means nothing if it wasn't real temptation. He was genuinely hungry. He was genuinely Satan was tempting him to bow down so that he could have the crown without the cross and so on. And I think it's very much after the pattern of 1 John 2, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life. And all those are real. There is physicality in it, but it clearly involves a dimension that is real. It's just as real as what we see about us. That makes sense to you? 3,800 times in the Old Testament, you have a phrase very, very much like, thus saith the Lord. Where did those prophets get the confidence they were speaking God's message? They got it, Numbers 12, in a vision, a dream. The most, I think, instructive dream of the Scriptures is perhaps Daniel 7, that we'll talk about Wednesday night, because or Tuesday night. In Daniel 7, Daniel has this remarkable vision of four beasts and then the Ancient of Days, and he just takes us by the hand and walks it through it. He gives us a guided tour. So I saw this, and I went over here, and I saw that. And what's fascinating about it is, you remember, Daniel is we're going to talk a lot about this, is overwhelmed at this little horn. So he says, I asked one of the angels standing by. He had a tutor. He had an instructor. And he could ask questions. So when you have these dreams, here's where I'm taking you. When you have these dreams, these revelatory dreams, you're conscious. What you see is real. Let me tell you something. I haven't mentioned this before, but it's a very important point with regard to the period of history we're talking about. In 592, the glory cloud departed. Now again, 586 is when Nebuchadnezzar is going to come the second time and level the temple and the city. But 6 years earlier, 592, because it's recorded and dated in Ezekiel 11, King Yahweh got out of Dodge, if you don't mind. That place was going to be leveled. Now, I think, and Ezekiel, who is in Babylon, found himself standing on the mountain, which is on the east of the city, which is, at least he describes it as part of the story. But he finds himself in Jerusalem, and he watches as real angels, cherubim, come from heaven to accompany the glory cloud. And now that massive, brilliant, glowing glory cloud lifted up, and he describes how it stood over the temple, then over the gate of the temple, and then over the mountain on the east of the city before it departed. I think if you'd have been there that day, if you'd have been standing there, I think you would have seen the glory cloud did depart. And I think you would have seen it. Now, if you were standing flat next to Ezekiel, you wouldn't have seen him. See what I'm saying? He's in that fourth dimension. It's real. He saw the cherubim. I don't think you'd have probably seen the cherubim. Does that make sense to you? So it interacts intimately. All right, what am I talking about? Why do I go down that road? Well, it's so important to understand that Nebuchadnezzar had that kind of dream. It was clearly not just another crazy, cartoonish, silly intermixing of various elements. That's not what happened. Is that how your dreams are, you know? And so Nebuchadnezzar, I got to finish the story, has a dream, and the Bible says he dreamed dreams, or he dreamed the dream. The idea seems to be that again and again, he didn't like to go to bed. His sleep break from him. That's the old King David. He didn't want to go to bed because he was fear of this dream. So as a young king, he makes a decree. Now, one of the questions I asked on your sheet is, did Nebuchadnezzar forget the dream? Here I've got just some questions. And let me just say, absolutely he did not. I'll tell you that idea, and some of you are old enough to remember this. How many of you were raised on the King James, right? I mean, many of us, that's all we knew. And this is what happens. Nebuchadnezzar calls the wise men in, not Daniel, because he's still in training. And he says, now listen, I've had a dream. I've dreamed it again and again. I need to know. And he doesn't say this, but I think it's implicit in what he says is, I know that this is from some sort of God. This is not a normal dream. And he's trying to tell me something. And I want to know what it is, and I know that all you wise men are a bunch of ear ticklers, and if I tell you the dream, you'll sit around, you'll come up with all sorts of ear-tickling ideas, but I want to know the truth about this dream, and you claim to be divinely connected, so this is what I'm going to demand of you. Tell me the dream and the interpretation. Now, he's a young man. He's brand new on the throne. You got to understand, this is his second year, so he's maybe 26-year-old, but his father died just about a couple years ago. or a year or so ago, and so all of these wise men say, now, wait a minute, young king. You're new. Who can blame you? But here are the protocols. You tell us the dream. We tell you the interpretation. That's how the game is played. And then he says this, no. And the old King James says this, the thing is gone from me. Now, out of that came a misinterpretation that he meant the dream. And he's saying, oh, I can't remember the dream. You have to tell me both the dream and the interpretation. Now, can you tell me what's wrong with that? Why doesn't that work? Pardon me? Yeah, exactly. What are the choices? Littler pieces? You know what I'm saying? You hear what he said? Nebuchadnezzar says, if you don't tell me both the dream and the interpretation, I'm going to chop you in little pieces and make your houses a dunghill. I always think after the little pieces business, do what you want with the house. You know what I'm saying? But no, I think it actually means the family. But the point is, you can hear what, as you say, if he said he forgot the dream, why not just make something up? What's he going to do? Like I say, littler pieces maybe. So it makes no sense to, and out of that came a position for a time, this is just kind of an interesting history of interpretation, called the hazy recollection, that he had he could remember enough that he could call you if you made something up. Okay. The point is, forget all that. The thing, he says, the thing is gone from me. The reference is not to the dream, but to the decree. And later translations will say the decree is firm. Now, it's an expression. It's an Aramaic expression. But it's this section of the book is in Aramaic. But the fact is that what he says is, no, the decree is firm. You are going to tell me both the dream and the interpretation. Now, folks, it is unspeakably important that you understand that all of these wise men, all of these soothsayers, all of these pretended priests, and can I say this? When you think our how do we understand our relationship to God? What does God demand of us? Or what is our relationship to God? We worship Him, we honor Him, we obey Him. That's not the idea in pagan worlds. With pagan gods, you manipulate the gods. And so you have priests who supposedly know the right incantations and the right rituals and so on to somehow figure out the mind of God, their small g gods, and then manipulate them to bless and so on. Well, all of that's a lie, but the fact of the matter is that you have representatives, this is so important, from all of these god systems. Everywhere Nebuchadnezzar had gone, he had scooped up wise men and the pagan priests and so on, and they all say it can't be done. Now, what happens, of course, is as they were being lined up and taken out to experience said punishment, the word gets to Daniel. And Daniel realizes, my God can do that. And so you can read it yourself. I mean, he goes to his friends and they pray and they acknowledge that God can do that. And so he is brought before Nebuchadnezzar and he tells them both the dream and the interpretation. Now, I want to stay with the story, so I'll just very quickly, the dream is that Nebuchadnezzar had seen a great statue with four metals, and the metals were descending in terms of their value as a metal. They were ascending in terms of their strength, and the suggestion is that their raw capacity to govern gets less and less, but their dependence upon raw power gets greater and greater. You do what you want with that, but bless the Lord. What happens is, in the latter days of those four metals, which represent four kingdoms, a stone cut out without hands rolls out and pulverizes and grinds to dust like chaff that is blown away in the wind. It's nothing and it's gone. All of that of those empires, and that stone becomes a fifth world kingdom. Now we're going to talk about that more Tuesday night. But suffice it to say for now, Daniel interprets the dream, and I want you to see. If I can talk my machine into I just need to bring the cord. But let me take you to the end of Daniel 2, and it's so significant. Now, at the end of Daniel 2, after, and by the way, I have highlighted here, this is the insistence of the pagan magicians. The Chaldean answered the king and said, "There's not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. No king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It's a difficult thing," the king said, "and there that requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." And now in comes Daniel, tells him both the dream and the interpretation. It's kind of long here. What's the best way to do this? And it's one of my favorite passages right there. "Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, and the silver, the gold were crushed together, became like chaff from the threshing, summer threshing floor, carried away so that no trace of them was found." I'll leave it alone. But and it becomes a great mountain that fills the earth, and that is the fifth kingdom. Can I just say this to you in this regard? I know I've said this here before, but folks, we need to train our soul spirits, and this is a biblical effort to really cherish the hope of an earthly kingdom. I like to say that people are, Christians, I think, are by and large over-fixated on going to heaven. Now, heaven is a wonderful place, as we say, and it certainly beats all the alternatives, if you know what I mean. But the fact is, I always think, I die, I go to heaven, I know bliss, and get to see my Savior and so on. But this world still lies in the lap of the evil one. And everything that is sacred and worthy is denigrated and despised and defiled. And everything that is perverted and wicked and twisted is honored. And aren't you tired of that? And again, where this, what is blessed about the kingdom is not primarily, now this is a blessing and praise God for it, that we will be citizens of that kingdom and we will know the peace and plenty that the world has forever desired in some imaginary utopian situation, but it's going to be here. But what is blessed about it is that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is the Christ to the glory of God the Father. And I love the verse in Habakkuk where Habakkuk says that in that day, the knowledge of the glory of the Lord will cover the earth as water covers the sea. Is that happening in Pine Island? You see what I'm saying? That's there is the idea that the kingdom is already here and that it's spiritual. It's just the God, reign of God in your heart. And one of the most discouraging dynamics or ramifications of that set of ideas, and they're brothers, but I absolutely reject those ideas. I think they're pernicious. But one of the most disappointing elements of that is that means that this is as good as God can do with human history. It's here. This is as good as it's ever going to get. I don't believe that, folks. And I'm just saying this kingdom, this stone rolling out of the mountain and smashing him by what alchemy of imaginative hermeneutics could we decide that you have four, you can name them, you can go to their capitals, you can study their history, you can trace their kings, you know their boundaries, you know their limits. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Those are real kingdoms. By what alchemy of interpretation do we decide that the fifth kingdom is just a spiritual kingdom? It's not a kingdom at all, it's just God ruling in individual hearts. You can't get there by interpreting the Bible. But anyway, I'm just saying that picture there. But here it is. This is where I'm taking you. I got to hurry. Then, this is the end of chapter 2. This is after Daniel has interpreted the dream, and Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel. Now, can you imagine this scene? Here's Nebuchadnezzar sitting up on some dais, and he's madder and hops, and of course, he's also really concerned because he doesn't want to go back to bed tonight for fear he'll dream the same dream, and all of these blokes who he's dragged over there and treated so well, none of them can do any of it. And now here comes this young 13, 14-year-old boy, and entirely in the name of Yahweh and being careful to give all the credit, all the glory to his king, he tells them the dream and the interpretation and every detail. And imagine the scene now. Imagine as everybody watches and Nebuchadnezzar the king gets up and throws himself on the ground before young Daniel. He fell on the ground prostrate before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. And I'm sure Daniel, demurred all this. But the king answered Daniel and said, now this is what I want you to hear. Truly, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Now, I don't think I'm reading too much into this, because it's interesting to me that this phrase right here, your God is the God of gods. We can say, and you'll often hear it's just sort of a Hebraism for his majestic superiority and so on, but from the lips of a polytheist, see what I'm saying? I don't think that's a true statement. He's not the greatest of all the gods. That's what he's saying. And again, you have to understand that this was a common, every king had, there were all these gods, and you can have all the gods you want, but because you live in my kingdom, you have to honor my gods, because my God is most powerful and most honored around here. And so Nebuchadnezzar is simply saying, we're wrong. Your God, now, just remember that. I'll hurry. And then it says, the king promoted Daniel, gave many gifts. He made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. And of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were given places of authority. Again, catch the parallel to Joseph. All right, now this is in 605, maybe 604, the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, in Daniel chapter 3, we have the second of the incidents, and I'm going to be very quick with this. I'm using up all my time. But honest to goodness, you know, I think you probably know this story. This is the fiery furnace, and we all know and cherish the fiery furnace. Let me just make a suggestion, and I can't prove this. I don't know if I ever talked about this, Tim, but I think there is, I would at least suggest to you that this happens in connection with 597 B.C., Now, know this. In 605, God raised up Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar came and took just a few young men. He left on the throne a man named Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim, after a few years, rebelled and withheld the tribute. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, for King Nebuchadnezzar, and now, again, if I'm right, I'm going to suggest that this happened in connection with this set of events. Because I think very possibly this is what happened. And I'm really filling in some big blanks, all right? But Nebuchadnezzar, again, this is 597 from 605. So Nebuchadnezzar is in his young 30s now. He's been king for 8 years. But he is absolutely, and I will insist on this even though it's only implicit in the record, he is absolutely dependent upon Daniel. And for this reason, by the way, folks, I think that God intends for the Joseph story to be a harbinger. So, and again, as I said to you this morning, people marvel at the kingdom under Nebuchadnezzar because it's so well run, but I think it was because of this remarkable man, Daniel. And I read you the passage this morning in Ezekiel 14. I did finally get to it, where even in his own day, a close contemporary saying in Ezekiel 20, what do you think? You're smarter than Daniel? You think you're wiser than Daniel? So I think Daniel was so much a primary part of the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. All right, now here's the point. Jehoiakim withholds the tribute. You have to understand. Here, I'm going to give you the Fertile Crescent. There's the Arabian Desert. Here's the Mesopotamian Belt Delta. Here's Babylon. Here's Israel. He is that Judah. That's the last stop. And you see, what any emperor, anybody who's got this extensive sequence of countries he's captured and put under tribute. His great concern is somebody out here withholds the tribute, and then the next year the guy just to the north says, what, am I stupid? He got away with it last year. He does too, and the whole thing starts to come apart. He can't put up with it. He can't allow this to happen. But I think Nebuchadnezzar is at least, I'm going to suggest something to you. I think he is at least very anxious not to anger Daniel. I think he knows how totally dependent he is on Daniel. Secondly, folks, I'm telling you, and it's not exact, but I think in understanding this whole flow of events, you've got to somehow factor in the impact that Daniel and his God are having on this man, Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar is probably skittish about going back there and going up against that God once again. But however you like it, what Nebuchadnezzar does is he marches across the Fertile Crescent, and rather, now this is rather standard, he takes 10,000 captives. He leaves the temple standing. By the time he gets there, Jehoiakim, the king who had withheld the tribute, had done his son the significant disservice of dying. So by the time Nebuchadnezzar showed up, it was Jehoiachin. I know you got a Kaniah, Jeconiah, and so on. But at any rate, so he deals with that king. He's only king for 3 months, and he gets rid of him. But the point, and he puts another man on the throne. So my point is, very possible, but this is where I'm taking you. Why, at this point in his reign, does, at whatever point, wherever you put it, why does all of a sudden Nebuchadnezzar decide he has to have an oath of allegiance to his gods for all the functionaries in his kingdom? See, I think, am I making sense? I think it may very possibly be that he knows he's got to punish those Judahites, those Jews. Now, he's got one Jew who is running the place, and he knows very well that Daniel is not going to bow down to his gods. But he can't have a whole thousands of people coming in here and refusing to worship his God. And I think he's also dealing with the fact that he probably by now has learned that his gods are pretty paltry next to this Yahweh God. So I think maybe the reason for the fiery furnace episode is that in anticipation of what he's about to do, go and punish the southern kingdom for withholding the tribute, he wants to make sure that he's on the record. You can have whatever gods you want, but you got to be loyal to my God. So however you like that, if so, then he's about 32 years old. He's about 8 years into his reign. He's still quite a young man. And you can see he's still a man of some passion. All right, you know the story. And by the way, so he calls in all the functionaries, everybody from the whole kingdom who has any role in his kingdom. He calls in, and they meet on the plain of Dura. I like Dura. Sounds like a 50s doo-wop song. You know, there ought to be a backup to that. But the point is that and he's got the orchestra, and he says, now listen, when you hear the orchestra, I want you to bow down to my God. And of course, the three Hebrew youths refuse to do it. And somebody comes and tells on them. And I love what happens. And by the way, in this regard, there is the question, and I don't think it's a very difficult question, as to why Daniel doesn't show up in this narrative. And I think the answer quite simply is, I like to say, that Nebuchadnezzar had Daniel locked in a closet. In other words, Daniel wasn't invited to this soiree. The whole point is, I know Daniel's not going to bow down, but I can't risk having all these tens of thousands of people I'm going to bring back here and having them resistant, and so I serve in the name of these. Folks, listen, let me tell you. Here's the arrangement in antiquity. The king, in this case Nebuchadnezzar, lives in a big palace. He fares sumptuously 3 times a day, and the rest of the country works hard every day in the hot field to make that happen. How do you perpetuate that arrangement? The answer is superstition. Because you see, the king reigns in the name of these gods. And he has a company of priests who know how to manipulate these gods. And if you want your crops to do well, if you want your children to be born alive, you better, you see the point? So his tryst, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar's tryst with these so-called tribal deities, these gods whom he has selected as his patron gods, that can't be violated because that's what perpetuates my rule. So the point is that so everybody comes together, the orchestra plays, word gets to Nebuchadnezzar that there were these three young Hebrews who did not, Jews who did not bow down. And look at verse 13 here. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the commandment to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought them, and in verse 15, if you are ready, he gives them a second chance. The orchestra's going to play. And if you bow down, then that's fine. But if you don't, and look at what's highlighted there, the last of verse 15, who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Can you remember another guy who sat on a throne and said, who is this God? Remember Pharaoh? He got an answer, didn't he? When Moses first came, who is this God? So now you have Nebuchadnezzar sitting on a throne, as it were, in some sort of diet. And who is this God? And he's going to get an answer. And you know the story well. They throw him in. He looks in. He sees the fire is so hot. Folks, see, Nebuchadnezzar knows who he's up against, as it were. Why did Pharaoh, when he went out to recover the fleeing Israelites under a glory cloud, by the way, why did he take all of his chariots? How foolish is it to take all of it? Because he knew this was his last chance. And by the same token, I think Nebuchadnezzar had some idea. So he heated the fire seven times hotter than usual, so that even the men throwing him in. Now he says, now this is the King James, and this is a really lousy translation. Okay, this is the New King James, but it says, well, you know this story. He looks in the furnace and he says, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire. They're not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like, now, they perpetuate the King James, so that's really unfortunate. What it says, like a son of the gods. The point is not that he looked in the fire and saw Jesus of Nazareth, okay? I doubt he would have known what Jesus looks like in the first place. But, and Jesus didn't exist at that point. The second person of the triune God did, and I think that's who's there. I think this is angel Lord. But what is it? As you're Nebuchadnezzar and you're looking in the mouth of that kiln, which has been heated seven times hotter than normal, and you see four people walking around to your surprise and amazement, one of them has something about it that makes him look godlike. I don't know, but I think it was probably his brilliance. Again and again, that's the glory cloud. The reason for that cloud was because you couldn't look upon it. And again and again, when God, in the Old Testament, you have a number of these pre-incarnate appearances in some physical form, and we believe it's the second person of the Trinity, and we call these theophanies or Christophanies, right? And again, they involve light, brilliant light, blinding light. And I think maybe that's what's at stake here. All right, by the way, we're out of here in 20 minutes. Can you handle that? I promise you. But the point is that so he looks in and he sees this fourth being, and you know the story. They bring him out, and now this is what I want you to see. And it's taken a step further. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel, his messenger, and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word." He acknowledges, I'm the king, I gave the command, bow down. I said, if you don't do it, you're going to be burned alive. They refused, and I didn't read it, but remember that noble passage where these three men, before they were thrown in the fire, had said to Nebuchadnezzar, look, we are not going to bow down. You do what you have to do, and if God saves us, fine, if not, otherwise, but you know, we are not going to bow down. And so they defied the king's word in the name of God, but they yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Folks, there is some theological acumen in that statement. He knew enough about Yahweh, Nebuchadnezzar did. He'd had Daniel alongside of him all of these years. He knew enough about Yahweh that the issue was monotheism, that Yahweh insisted he is the one God. And so they refused to do it. And then he says, now this is what I want you to see. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, shall be, here it is again, cut in pieces. And there, he didn't have a lot of creativity. He found one he liked and he stayed with it, you know, because that's what he promised before. But he says here, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. Now, notice he says, I make a decree. We're going to have that one more time in chapter 4. But you have to understand that when a Babylonian monarch would make a decree, there was a system by which that decree would be written out hundreds of times and given to a small army of heralds who would go throughout the land, and they would announce on such and such a day, be under the big bay tree in the middle of town, and then they would stand there and read that decree. So Nebuchadnezzar, his entire kingdom, spanning so much of the ancient world, everybody had to sit on some morning and listen as the decree was read that there is no God like Yahweh. But then it gets better, because I want you to see in chapter 4, and I'll tell you the story quickly. You know the story. I spell it out on your on the sheet, but I mean, I don't spell it out at all. I just summarize it. But I think most of you know the story that, there is some real question, and I discussed this on your sheet, but I'll just say there is some real question about when this happened. Almost everybody will acknowledge that it is toward the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He dies in 562. So he reigns from 605 to 562. And both Pentecost and John Whitcomb build a case in their commentaries. Whitcomb's is not a commentary, it's his discussion of end time prophecies, but then Whitcomb in his commentary on Daniel. But they suggest that this happened around 570. So by now, and my point is, and I think it really is part of the narrative, that by now Nebuchadnezzar's an old man. He's not good. He's a young man. He's 60, for heaven's sakes. You kidding me? But no, he's in that culture and so on. He's grown old, and he's grown old alongside of Daniel, folks. Everything we know about Daniel, and we get to know him fairly well, would suggest that he would leave a powerful impression on a man who lived alongside of him and worked with him year after year and so on. So he's grown old. But he has accomplished great things. And there are several attempts that I've seen to maybe correlate what happens. You have two events here. You have the one event where for some reason Nebuchadnezzar is just, he just is overwhelmed with pride. And he's become so proud that that Yahweh from heaven sends a dream. And then something, and he warns him. All right, so very quickly, Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. One element of this story that's a little curious is that he doesn't call Daniel in. He calls all the other soothsayers. And I think by now, frankly, and I'm reading a little into the story, I think you have in this story a significantly mellowed Nebuchadnezzar. He's not the impetuous, angry. So he calls the wise men. He doesn't make any threats. He tells them the dream. And they don't want to give him an interpretation. Now, why is not explicit, but I think anybody who listened to the dream, and Nebuchadnezzar would have insisted that this was another one of those revelatory dreams. This isn't another some silly nocturnal exercise. This is a dream. But he tells them the dream. And I think they realized that aged Nebuchadnezzar, this is not good news. And so at the last, in fact, he calls in Daniel. And it's so interesting to me that the first thing that Daniel says after Nebuchadnezzar tells him the dream is, "Oh, king, would to God this dream had been given to your worst enemy." And I think that reflects a significant personal relationship between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. But very, very simply, he tells him the dream about the tree, and it's cut down, and watchers are set, and a band of iron around it, and so on, and seven times, which I take to be 7 years, pass over it, and so on, and then the tree is restored. And so Daniel says to him explicitly, "Nebuchadnezzar, give the glory to God." Now, this is the more significant given the fact that Jeremiah and other prophets of the age had said again and again that Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon were, in fact, the rod of God's anger. God had raised them up to use them. But he says to Nebuchadnezzar, "You need to give God the glory." Well, something happens. Might have been a conquest. We don't know for sure. But something happens. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar just finds himself on the wall. Now, I'm not going to spend any time with it. But you can go back. That city has been well dug, and it is one of the most amazing archaeological sites in the world, ancient Babylon. And had this mammoth wall and the hanging gardens you hear about. So maybe Nebuchadnezzar just found himself one night standing on the roof of his palace and looking across this massive, massive, beautiful, well-fortified and plentiful city, and just what got caught up with himself. But he said, "Is not this mighty Babylon, which I have built by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" And while the words were still in his mouth, he staggered to his knees, and for 7 years he behaved like an animal. And they had to keep him outdoors. And a lot of scholars will say it can't be. It says seven times. It's a little ambiguous, but the same phrase is used elsewhere in the book, and it must mean years. And I think it is 7 years. But the fact is, not the fact, some people will say, well, no, it can't be 7 years. Who was running the kingdom? Daniel was running the kingdom. Like I said, I think Nebuchadnezzar was sleeping late anyway. But however you like that, the fact is that for 7 years, he behaves like an animal. And then he is restored according to, now, while I have it here, with this we're done, but notice what you have here at the beginning. And this is the beginning of chapter 4. Chapter 4 is probably the only chapter in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that was written by a non-Jewish person. This is actually written by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, he may have had Daniel's help, I don't know. But Nebuchadnezzar, so it says, Nebuchadnezzar the king to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. So this is actually, I said before, that when, because he is going to make it a decree, and this is the decree, I thought it good to declare the signs and wonder that the Most High God has worked with me. And then he tells his story, how greater is signs and how mighty his works. And he says, Nebuchadnezzar, I was the rest of my house, I was flourishing. And then he tells you the story I just told you. Now, let me jump to the end. It's rather a long chapter. But let me point out to you, Daniel comes in and interprets the dream. But now, Nebuchadnezzar says, this is where he grows proud. And so verse 33, just as he's saying, is there's not mighty Babylon which I built. That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, and he wouldn't... But then he says this. Now, this is what I want you to catch. All right, folks. I am saying that what is as central as any other point to this marvelous little book is that it describes for us how it is that God protected his honor at a time when his name was so thoroughly in danger of being disreverenced. And furthermore, the way he did it was primarily through Daniel. Now in Daniel chapter 1 and 2, when Daniel interpreted the dream, it was evidently the core of wise men and magicians and so on that had to acknowledge. Because they had just said, remember chapter 1? We can't do it. No God can do it. Daniel's God does it. Then in chapter 3, you've got everybody in the whole, the diplomatic corps, if you know, anybody who's involved in the governance of Babylon coming together, and they watch. They watch three guys. Can you imagine their horror as they watch these three guys and the soldiers who are deputized to throw them in are burned alive just in the effort and so on. But then a few minutes later, they come walking out. See, in the morning, all those people are going to get in a bus and go home. What do you think they're going to be talking about? And then some weeks later, a Babylonish official is going to ride into town and say, hey, I need to read you this decree. I'm going to read this decree in Daniel 3 that don't be anybody say anything amiss about this God Yahweh. But now here's my point. I want you to imagine, not to imagine, but I want you to try and recreate in your own mind the significance of this. When a decree is made, Daniel 4 is the decree, and every human ear in the Babylonish kingdom has got to sit and quietly listen as the entirety of Daniel 4 is read aloud. And Nebuchadnezzar gives this testimony of how, by reason of his pride, Yahweh had humbled him. And when he gets done, this is the end of it. He says, at the end of time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. My understanding returned to me. I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who is eternal. Time out. I know you're anxious, but let me just tell you something. One of the ways in which God distinguishes Himself again and again in Scripture is that He never began to be. This is Yahweh. And the other gods, they were birthing one another, you know, all the pagan gods and mythologies and so on. And there is some remarkable, I think, theological maturity and insight into what Nebuchadnezzar said. He acknowledges, he prays and honors this one who lives forever, who is eternal. Not just in that direction, but in that direction, if you don't mind. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom is, this is Yahweh, is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And He does according to His will in the army of heaven. In other words, all those other gods mean nothing to Him. And He says, and among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain Him or say to Him, what have you done? And at the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. He is a king. My counselors, nobles resorted to me, and I was restored to the kingdom, and excellent majesty was added. And He says this, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and His ways justice, and those who walk in pride He is able to put down. That's a stunning testimony. Now, I know that there is a lot of debate about this, but I personally, I'm convinced we're going to see Nebuchadnezzar in heaven. I know this is not uncommon, but the fact of the matter is that there is a certain amount of genuine confession there. He had been prideful, and he recognizes that God had punished him, and that punishment was just. He is acknowledging the justice of the way God has handled him and so on, and he is praising and extolling the one God of heaven. Listen, more and more I'm convinced that, and with this I'm done, I promise. I think the best working synonym for biblical faith is our word allegiance. And I say that because we're not going to leave the word faith. There's a guy, and it's actually a pretty good book. He comes out of a very different background than we do, but he wrote a book called Saved by Grace Through Allegiance. That's the name of the book, and he's picking up on Ephesians 2. And he argues that we have Platonized or Neoplatonized. In other words, we've made faith some sort of either, on the one hand, it's just some abstraction, you know, some mental exercise by which you sit in a room and you just say, I believe. I really believe. What's that all about? Where does that get you? Or we treat it as, I always say, we treat it faith as Popeye's spinach can, if you know what I'm saying. That you need faith to do this. You remember the Popeye? I'm not the guy roaming, you know, and he's getting beat up by Bruto, and all of a sudden, bing, and he can. And so we regard faith as an extra measure of strength by which we can do something. Faith is never a strength. Faith is an admission that I have no strength. Faith is dependence. Now, my point is simply this, that rather than sort of abstracting the whole idea, it becomes so much more concrete if you understand it as allegiance. And what I mean by that is, and I think this comes right out of the Old Testament, where again and again, you'd have this or that nomadic people, and here's a king who's got, I always say most of the kings in the Old Testament are kinglets, you know, they just got a walled city somewhere, and they got several peoples who follow them, so you come and you're tired of being a nomadic people, and you say, okay, we will make a treaty with you, and you will be our king, and we'll be your people. What does that mean? What does that mean? We'll give you our allegiance. You know what that means? Number one, we're going to trust you for our security. We're entirely going to entrust ourselves to you. You are in charge of taking care of us. That's what it is to come to God. And number two, what you tell us is what we're going to do. Now that's biblical faith. Now my point is, I can almost hear Nebuchadnezzar swearing allegiance to King Yahweh here. So, but I want to finish where we ought to finish, and that is this, that, and it's not over yet, because there's going to be one more Babylonish king with whom Daniel, very late in his life, is going to interact, and that's Belshazzar in chapter 5, the handwriting. We'll talk about that tomorrow night. And then, of course, he's going to interact with a Persian king by the name of Darius, whoever that might be. So Daniel's ministry is not over. Nebuchadnezzar is soon to die. But my point is, the record is laid out in such a way as to help us understand how it was at this hugely strategic time in human history, when God's name was in serious danger, God used young Daniel, 13, 14 years old, hauled off to Babylon. And in the course of those several decades of his life, his interaction, again and again, God worked in such a way that the name of Yahweh was honored throughout the kingdom. And God knows how to protect his glory, and he does it. Sometimes through very humble servants. That makes sense to you? I said this morning, but I'm really persuaded of this. I think you can only make sense of the wise men. I'm talking about the wise men who came to Jesus when he was a baby. If you understand that they were spiritual descendants of Daniel. They knew Daniel. They knew the timetable and so on. And I think it's so big to understand, not only did Daniel, not only did God, through Daniel, preserve his name, but he glorified his name. He demonstrated who he was to the world. And I think the primary agent, in the record anyway, was Daniel. Does that make sense to you? All right, we'll have a word of prayer and be done. Thank you for your patience. I know I'm putting you to sleep here. Did the Vikings go down to ignominious defeat today? Or I didn't see it, but what's that? No, I watched a little bit of it. It was fairly boring football, to be honest with you. But that's all right. All right, but thanks for staying at it, and let's have a word of prayer. Father, we do honor you as our God and our King, and we bow the knee and swear our allegiance to you as King, as God. And Father, we have entrusted ourselves to you in this life and the next, and we want to be quick to obey, and we want to know you better day by day. And so even as we contemplate these marvelous stories, which we've enjoyed, many of us, since childhood, but help us to understand anew just this remarkable dynamic that you are, in fact, jealous for your own glory. And you are going to work it out and, again, make us vehicles of your glory. Help us to live lives in such a way that those who know us will have a higher regard for you, our God, than they possibly could have if they had never known us. So, Father, we thank you for these narratives and ask that you would make yourself glorious in our lives. Thank you for these folks and pray that you go before us now in Christ's name. Amen.